On 11.16 SEN, Melbourne's home of footy, The Science of Sport, with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada and Mark Fabreo.
Oh, we could have gone a tiny bit longer because I had a sip of my tea. What are you doing to me, Mikey? Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Mikey, Panelop. Good morning, Jackie, our producer. Good morning, Jackie Lauder, my co-host, the great talent that steers the ship that is The Science of Sport every Sunday between 10 and 11, folks. Hi, chap.
Hi, how you going?
Pretty good, thanks. And you?
Oh, good. Enjoying the weather.
Now, I just thought of something. You know, I'm going to start with this because you and I, we have no plan today. We've got no plan. Jackie said, Jackie, our producer said, which she does every Sunday, what should I put up on the screen? You know, like talking points. And we normally just rattle. And we went, don't worry about it today. We're just going to freestyle. So what we're going to say to you is if you would like to help plan our show, if you've ever wanted to be a producer, if you've ever wanted to have some kind of creative input into what gets shared on radio, I promise you, as long as it's not stupid, we will talk about it. If you SMS us right now, 0433 98 11 16, 0433 98 11 16, help us put the show together. Or if you want to talk to us about something specifically right new, 94 29 11 16. Now, I know we do have a few things to talk about, but I listened to... Now, we don't want anyone to not listen to us or SEN at any stage ever. But if you get caught in some kind of zone where you don't have access to internet and you've downloaded a podcast, very recent one, Joe Rogan and a guy called Shannon Briggs, who's a heavyweight boxer from the States. My goodness, Jax, you as a psychologist, you would... Oh, my God. What an interesting story of somebody coming from, you know, everybody's...
So it was about his
story. It's about his story. So he was born at under 2 pounds.
Oh, wow.
Right? So I'm guessing, I don't know what that was in, a kilo and a bit. Oh, no, less than a kilo, isn't it? Oh, my goodness. So he must have been about 800 or 900 grams, but under 2 pounds. He was in hospital for the first month, 8 months of his life.
Yeah, not surprising.
As a child, he was abused in a bunch of ways. His father was in prison when he was born. He never got to know his father ever. His mother was a heroin addict when he was born and continued to be a drug addict.
Goodness.
Drug user until she passed away. Now, and some of our listeners will know who Shannon Briggs is. And his story is just the peaks and troughs, the highs and lows, way, way more lows. Woke up one day when he was 40 and he was 408 pounds, Jack, 408 pounds, and had just had a new baby girl, 40 years old, two boys, and went, that's it. Lost 160 pounds. He's back in the top two or three world in the heavyweight rank, two or three
at
in
40?
The world. No, he's now 44.
Wow.
Heading for 45 and looking to challenge for a world title as a heavyweight. Back better than ever. Gave up sugar, gave up... It's just a... You know when you hear people talk and you just think... Sometimes I think my life's a bit tough. My life's not tough at all. But one of those great stories of... psychology and overcoming adversity and the social stuff, the mental stuff, the physical stuff, the lessons learned in adversity. So his name's Shannon Briggs, and if you get a chance, have a listen. It's on the Joe Rogan or JRE, Joe Rogan Experience. But very, very good thing to
but
listen
to. But
you
never know, and I was talking to an athlete through the week about this, because athletes tend to compare themselves to other athletes a lot, and this is one of the performance issues that we certainly as psychologists deal with all the time, is athletes focusing on what they can't control rather than what they can. But you don't have all of the information. What people see in the public and how someone performs on the footy field or on the tennis court or in the swimming pool or whatever it is, you don't know some of the stories that some of these athletes have gone through. And not even at the elite level, but sport saves a lot of people, I think, like in terms of having something in their lives. And
for sure,
there's quite a bit of research on sports fans. And and I'm a big believer that, particularly when we see AFL, some of the cheer squads and those things who have copped a bit of flack over the years.
That's their church.
For the demographic. That so is. And the depression that some people go through in the off season it is quite significant because they've lost that family. And if they weren't going to the footy and supporting their team, they would be at home drinking or suffering from other things. So I think we forget, we look at the bells and whistles of sport sometimes, but I think we forget the underlying stories, and there's some amazing ones around.
Is it Dunbar's principle, I think, which talks about how we work in tribes, and and not that long ago, if you look at the timeline of humanity, not that long ago, most people or a lot of people in the world existed in tribes or groups of about 150.
Yep.
And apparently that's kind of the optimal number. I don't know where that came from. I think it's called Dunbar's principle or Dunbar's rule, something like that. But I guess I never even thought of it till you just said that. Peter and Elston Witt will come to you in a moment. But I guess the thing is that for a lot of people, it's a bit about the footy, but it's more almost about the social benefits and the connection and the camaraderie and the, for want of a better term, the love that they get.
Yep.
And that connection that they have.
Well, I know I go to the footy with my dad and my sister regularly, and we have the same seats, and we've been sitting with the same people for many years now. And, you know, I genuinely enjoy seeing those people. And yeah, you watch the game and everything else, but it is about catching up with them and over Christmas and that. Like, you miss not having that contact with them because they're such nice people, and they've sort of become part of your weekly life.
And even with me at the ripe old age of 53, I go to the gym every day, but I now train with this small, I call them my merry band of misfits, right, because we're all broken and busted and his shoulder's okay, but his back's stuffed and his hips rooted. But he can, you know, it's just this collection of misfits. Fits who used to be awesome, and the older we get, the more awesome we were, right? But the training is secondary. Like, we all love to train, and I would train anyway. I definitely don't need a training partner, but I love a training partner.
But your brain's a social organ. Like, we need that social. That's why years ago when you read all these stories about prisoners who were put in solitary confinement, so they had no light and no humans.
Oh, total deprivation.
Of course they're going to go crazy, because your brain is a social organ. You need to have contact with people. And that's, you know, one of the key things when people start suffering depression is that they will often isolate themselves. And we say, just try, and even if it's just, you know, not necessarily interacting, but at least seeing people, you need to be part of the world. And sport does that for so many people.
And because of that fact, I opened a business which turned into, well, it would have turned into an industry without me anyway, but personal training. And people go to me, have said many times, well, why do people need a trainer? And I go, well, you know what? The truth is, people get to a point where they don't need a trainer, but they want a trainer because they much more enjoy the process of working out or running or lifting or whatever it is with someone with them, even if it's a someone that they pay, because they still have connection and relationship and conversation and interaction.
Accountability and everything
accountability
else.
And motivation and all of that stuff, rather than just rocking up and doing it by himself. So one, the enjoyment factor is greater, but so too is the compliance factor in terms of following through.
Yep.
If you want to chat with us, give us a buzz, 9429 1116. How do you stay motivated on these gloomy, it's not even meant to be gloomy. What's going on out there?
I don't know.
On these gloomy, almost summer days. Let's go to Peter in Elston Week. G'day, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good. Thanks. A couple of weeks ago, you had a go at Mark Fabreo, making a laugh at him about how your mother needed a training partner.
Yes.
And I thought, you know what? I'm at that stage. Look, I'm 67. I go to the gym, and I can't. My weights have stopped. I can't take the weights up. I can't get my weight down. And, you know, I've almost reached the stage where I think I want to give up. You know, it's hard to get motivated.
Yeah, it certainly is, Peter. I think, like, one of the things we were just talking about, thanks for your call, by the way, one of the things we were just talking about then is, like, you do get to a point, and I'm almost at that point now where, well, I am at that point, I'm not going to get any stronger. So my goal in terms of training and lifting weights and is to remain injury free, or to remain as free as injury as possible, to be as functional as possible as long as I can, to keep as much muscle and to keep as much strength as I can. And so I think a couple of things that you can do to stay more motivated and more focused. One is to get yourself a training partner. And I know I say that all the time, but my experience and my observation is that people that have a workout buddy, training partner, whatever you want to call them, enjoy it more and stay with it more. Second thing is set yourself some regular goals so you've got something to aspire to, and do some regular kind of check-ins.
Yeah, and Peter, the other thing I would ask you is, what's causing you to be demotivated? Because a lot of people look at how do I get more motivated, but you've got to look at what's standing in your way. So what's demotivating you? Is it time? Is it the environment of a gym? Is it the weather, the time of day? What is it that demotivates you?
I kind of enjoy going to the gym. I go 4 or 5 nights a week
right.
after work. But I've just reached a stage where I'm not losing any weight. I can't get my weight down, and I can't lift any heavier weights.
Have you changed your exercises? Like, or are you doing the same thing over and over?
No, I haven't. Because the gym I go to, no one sort of shows much interest in showing you what to do. And right. I've been doing, I just watch what other people do, and I think, well, I'll do those tonight. I'll do this, I'll do that.
Okay, you need much more of an individualised approach.
Yeah, Jackie makes a great point, Peter, and that is if you do the same thing the same way, there's no need for your body to adapt, so you won't see much progress. But, like, if, for example, tonight we gave you in the gym, we gave you 10 new exercises. Tomorrow you'd get up and you'd be really sore, whereas doing your normal program you might not be.
Yep.
And it's not because you're investing more time or doing a different activity. It's just that you're doing a similar activity but a different way. So change it up a little bit. Thanks for your call, man. Let's go to Monty in Geelong. G'day, Monty. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
No probs.
I'm nearly 40. I feel like I'm in the best shape that I've ever been in. But if I don't go to the gym, I will just shred, just lose muscle. And I find it hard to keep the gains.
Yep.
How often are you going to the gym?
On average, 4 times a week.
Are you, describe you to us when you were 15 years old. Is he gone?
We've lost him.
Monty, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
When you were 15 year old, were you a chubby kid, a skinny kid, a muscly kid? What were you?
Tall and skinny. I've always been tall and skinny.
Yeah. Okay. So you're probably, just guessing, but you're probably what we call an ectomorph, or bodybuilders would call you a hard gainer, which is somebody that you work hard. You know, you probably have a relatively quick metabolism. You're probably naturally pretty lean, but it takes a while to get muscle. I mean, there's a couple of things. Obviously, strength training is a must. I would be doing relatively short-ish, intense-ish workouts rather than long kind of muscular endurance kind of workouts. Make
heavy,
sure you...
Heavy weight?
Yeah, heavy-ish. Remember, heavy is relative. And there's, I mean, we need to be careful with this stuff because I've never even seen you. But in general terms, yeah, heavy for you, good form, good technique. Assuming you've got no injuries, reasonably heavy, reasonably hard, warm up well. Make sure you get enough protein. For some people, protein, lack of protein, you don't want to overdo it. But the recommendation, the general recommendation for general population is 0.8 of a gram of protein per kilo of body weight. So let's say you weighed 80 kilos. You might, a dietitian will tell you better than me, but you might be looking at something around 1.5 grams of protein per kilo body weight, which would be somewhere around 120 grams. But again, that's not a prescription, just that's kind of what some people are using. And keep your cardio to stuff that's not going to strip, you know, like lots of running. Great for your heart. If you're going to do running, do short, sharp, do interval stuff. Otherwise, do... some intervals on the bike. So, for example, all I do these days is soft sand walking and interval training on the bike, and that'll help you hold on to the most muscle. Okay?
I'm pretty lucky. I do have mates I can train with.
Yep.
And I am doing well. I do have heaps of supplements. It's just a matter of being able to get that muscle.
Yeah. Well, mate, you're doing everything right. More compound movements than isolation movements. Listen to your body, because when you actually grow is not in the gym, it's when you sleep, when you recover, and when you eat. Thanks for your call. Keep listening to the show. Mikey, our panel op, is out there doing a front double bicep, reminiscent of my mum once again. We're going to go to our first break because we can. It's the Science of Sport. Jackie Louder, me, Craig Harper. If you want to give us a buzz, just get on the phone, 9429 1116.
On 1116 SEN, Melbourne's home of footy, The Science of Sport, with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada, and Mark Fabreo. So good,
I got you. Welcome, well, there I am. It's on. Welcome back to Melbourne's Home of Sport. Melbourne's Home of Footy. Melbourne's Home of Sport. Same thing. Tomatoes, tomatoes. 24 minutes past 10 o'clock. Jackie Lauder. Professor Mark Fabreo is away today. Away today. Now, the national draft, of course, has just transpired. There's been to-ing and fro-ing, speculating. Young men being
given an opportunity
and finding new homes in the big wide world of professional football. And Jackie, you're just perusing the paper today, and not often I see your knickers in a knot, bees in your bonnet, but I'm seeing both knotted knickers and bees in bonnet. Two metaphors that probably are unfortunate, but what's bothering you a little bit?
Okay, so Peaky and that talked about it in the last hour briefly. In the Herald Sun today, page 82, 83, there's an article on every trick in the book about the questions that draftees get asked. And I know some of these questions because I've worked with a number of boys over the years, and they tell you when they're giving you feedback about how their interviews went at their draft camp or whatever it is.
So boys that you've worked with post draft camp come to you and the conversation.
And you just say, well, how many interviews did you have and what sort of questions did they ask? Because we try and prep them. Well, I certainly try and prep them. I know some of my colleagues do as well. Just so that, you know, they feel like they can answer and represent themselves as best they can. Now, you've got to remember the mental state these kids are going in when they have these interviews. They desperately want to get drafted. They've been planning this for a long time and work their butts off through the TAC programs and everything else. So they're going to be a little bit nervous. Plus, they're sitting in rooms with well-known people who they want to sell themselves
to. It's all new. It's all unfamiliar. It's a bit intimidating. And let's be honest, 17-year-old, 18-year-old boys are not necessarily the most mature and not necessarily the best communicators.
Right. So I'm a big believer in just, if you're going to ask a question, ask it for a particular reason. I'm not into humiliating athletes or whatever, and I'm certainly not into power playing. So I'm reading the questions today, and they are accurate. These are questions that are 100% asked of athletes, but I have a real issue with them. Like, some of the stupidity of these questions, I have to say.
What are some of the questions? Okay, so these are questions that are being asked to some of the potential draftees.
So the article is accurate. I have no problem with that. It's the questions that are getting asked. So clubs are asking, tell me every reason why we shouldn't draft you. Mm. Are you goddamn kidding me? Seriously.
So they're asking,
you've got an
18-year-old
kid who wants to be drafted. Mentally, they're already under pressure. Mm. What are we doing? Are we power tripping with these kids? That is not testing the comfort zone of an athlete. Like, at all. Why would you go into a draft or go into any situation and go, tell me why we shouldn't?
And why would you want their mindset to be focused on that? Why would you want them to start to consider that? All right, what are some of the other? So these are questions, if you've just joined us, these are questions that are being, some questions that are being asked of some young men in the national draft.
Yeah. Sell us this packet of chewing gum. Well, we're not hiring salesmen.
Say that again. Sell
us this packet of chewing gum. So they've handed a packet of chewing gum across the table and said, sell it to us. Mm. We're not testing their sales and their marketing skills. And if these kids do get drafted, they get well trained by their clubs on media and that, but they're not going to be the ones that are at the front of it for most of the season and everything else. So asking them to do that, I do not see a point to that. And it does not translate to they go under pressure. There's no psychological basis for that whatsoever.
And I guess even if they did a good job of selling the chewing gum, does that necessarily mean that there'll be a correlation between that and them performing well as footballers in the next year or five?
No, but see, then the article goes on to say that they've spoken to Adrian Dodoro and that, and they've said the answer's really, it doesn't matter, you can't be wrong or right. Well, then don't ask it.
So are they really just trying to see how they respond under pressure?
Yeah, but if they're considering drafting this kid, clearly they've watched them playing football, the actual thing we're drafting them for, under pressure. Why are you asking this? Got me fired up.
I can tell. Where do you think this comes from? It must come reasonably highly recommended by somebody if an organisation like the AFL has considered it. Because at some stage, somebody's gone, right, these are the kind of things that are going to be asked. And then someone who makes decisions in this space has gone, all right, let's go ahead with that.
Yeah, well, the article here speaks to the Essendon psych, and I can tell you right now, and I don't have anything to do with this particular psychologist, I'm not bagging his psychological skills, but if these are the questions, I can tell you 100% myself and a couple of my close colleagues, no way in hell we'd be suggesting these questions. So if people are reading this article thinking this is coming from most of the sports psychs, no, absolutely not. Like, I mean, you would hope that the psych has something to do with the questions and is getting a say. But if this is what they're suggesting, I'm concerned about my profession if this is what we think
so
is okay.
So are you saying to me, as somebody who works in the space with athletes, that this kind of this approach, in your opinion, and these questions would in no way indicate whether or not a player is going to be any good?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, if do you bite your fingernails? I do not understand how that is relevant. If the coach asked you to coat hanger someone at the first bounce, would you? That's a really rough question to be asking a 17 or 18 year old. Do you pick up your dog's poo? What?
I don't know.
You know, like, spell Gatorade backwards. Now, either my guess is the only reason you could possibly be asking that question is because the people doing the interview are doing their own little crossword and they don't know the answer, so they've got to ask a kid who's smarter than them, what's the answer?
How does this stuff get through? Like, when we talk about...
Because clubs can do their own thing.
In general, in sport and in science, there needs to be some kind of efficacy, some kind of... You know, this needs to have some level of success over time before it'll be adopted into an organisation or a league. Surely, it must have succeeded on some level somewhere else.
Well, I think if this is just going through and it's not being checked, which it obviously isn't, every club can ask their own questions. They're in their own room. But, you know, maybe we need to be doing more education with the clubs around this sort of stuff, because this is not fair on the kids that we're asking to go to the draft who are already nervous. They're going to say, you know, whatever they think that these coaches want them to say. But if there's no relevance to a question and you're saying the answer doesn't matter, then why are you asking it?
9429 1116, some of the weird and wonderful testing and protocols and things, hurdles that need to be jumped for some of our potential superstars to get drafted into the AFL and other sports. Let's go to Damien in Lancefield. G'day, Damien. Thanks for joining us.
G'day, Craig. I'm a PE teacher and personal trainer and have had a bit of experience with elite junior footy in terms of working with their fitness staff.
Yep.
And in my experience, the people who are making the decisions at clubs, TAC and AFL, tend to be people without a tertiary background.
Correct.
A background in physical education or sports psychology. And were simply doing what they were told or they had experienced as players 20 years before that.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with guys who are just sort of making stuff up, and this seems effective, and this will sort them out, this sort of stuff. I once saw a junior elite coach get some under 18 kids from a TAC club do a beep test on a really hot day, and he wasn't impressed with how they went, so he did it again straight away. I mean, that's sort of old school stuff. It's like the Kevin Sheedy, you know.
It still happens.
It still happens, yeah. And it's basically because it's an industry that is quite insular. It's lots of ex-footballers who become assistant coaches, who become coaches.
With no education in between.
Nah, cycle repeats. And you say, you know, they have lots of training. They do, but most of that training is with those guys. You know,
So
you get a little bit of work with the psych, or you get a bit of work with the phys ed guys, but... Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah, look, I agree with you, and there's been, I won't say when or where, but many times when I've been working for a sporting organisation, many, where I've said, right, this is what I think we should do tonight. These are the reasons why. I'm talking about in terms of conditioning and recovery and based on where the athletes are at, based on the weather, based on their level of fatigue. And somebody who has no exercise science background goes, nah, we're not doing that.
Yep.
And you go, what are you paying me for? Thanks for your call, Damien. It's frustrating. And I understand that, especially with AFL, it's a multi-layered sport. This sounds almost contradictory, but are there too many chiefs? Even when I was involved in the AFL a decade or more ago, when we would have a coaching staff meeting, it was a cast of thousands. Yeah. I mean, and today it's three times worse. There are so many people that want their 5 minutes with the players and want to prove their value. And then you've got all of these other people. Obviously, of course, we need coaching staff, of course, and they're great and they're amazing. But surely the football stuff should be their area, not the conditioning, not the medical, mm-hmm. not the psychology, not the nutrition. And so when you pay an expert to advise you on psych, managing players, you know, personalities and kind of psychological states and emotional states, you know, I know you and I have had unofficial conversations where you want to punch yourself in the face, where you go, this company's paying me or this organization's paying me to tell them what to do. I tell them what to do and why. It's completely legitimate. And then they go, nah.
Yep.
Is that...
If you want to know how a kid works under pressure or whatever it is, why can't we ask them directly? Like, if I'm sitting there, I would want to know from this kid and say, over the last year with your football, what are the situations you felt that you handled really well? Mm. And why do you think you handled that well? What are the things as a footballer you would really like to develop?
Yeah.
Are there particular players at our club that you look at and you like parts of their game, you know, that you feel you can develop and you would benefit from being in a team with these people? Like, just see from that perspective their own self-awareness or, you know, their ability to give you a really rational, reasonable answer. Then you've got someone who can think.
Mm.
But
And ask them perhaps, if you want to ask them tricky questions, ask them tricky football questions.
Correct.
Like, give them a scenario in a game. Give them some kind of... you know, some made up kind of situation that you would have to make a decision or react a certain way. What would you do in this situation? Yep. How would you respond? At least it's football specific. At least we can get an insight into your football brain.
Correct.
And how you think.
If I'm going to draft you, so we've obviously done our research, we've watched you. Why couldn't we as a club say, okay, in this particular match, we saw you in this situation. This is what unfolded. Can you talk us through this from your perspective? Like, how did you find that situation?
Yeah.
Like, get them to be reflective. Show that you've done your homework on them. Not ask them, what is 217 divided by 3? Well, a kid these days is going to use a calculator. So what is that going to tell you, that they know how to push the buttons?
Almost time to go for a break. But before we do, let's chat with John in Essendon. G'day, John. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to talk about, you're saying that for the last 20 years or 30 years, this sort of system's been going on. And the AFL keeps on producing champion player after champion player, so maybe the system works.
Yeah, there's no doubt, John, but what we're talking about is one particular very, very small component which doesn't seem to make sense to us. And
yeah, but can I also say, like, what they're asking, they're getting the answers that they obviously need.
No,
so,
well,
they're not.
But that's what you're saying to... justify your job.
No, well, I'm not an excess. I'm not a psychologist, and I'm saying it because, well, explain to us, John. This is a conversation. Well,
if someone said to me, "Why shouldn't you get this job?" And the person started listing off all these reasons why they shouldn't get the job, I'd be going, "What's wrong with this person?" Like, the person should say, "There's no reason why you shouldn't hire me. I'm not saying I'm perfect, but." You know, there's...
Yeah, but you've got an 18-year-old kid who's been desperate to get into the draft.
And $300,000, you want some answers.
Yeah, your brain doesn't stop growing till you're 24. These kids are 18 years old.
You're still going to pay him $300,000. You're not going to just...
Not the 18-year-old, you're not.
Yes, you are.
No, you're not.
The first-round draft pick gets paid up to $300,000.
Yeah, look, I know what you're saying, John, but I guess at the same time, we're not paying these guys... to be able to answer things like that. We're paying them for their football skills and their football brain. But look, it's a tricky one, and I guess there's no absolute right or wrong in this. But thanks for your call. Last one before we go to the break. Let's go to Tony in Diamond Creek. Hey, Tony, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hey, Tony. Welcome. Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I just wanted to speak about the previous call I had. It was
talking in relation to the system and how what they're asking maybe already be working. But these days, everything's evolving, and I think the system can only get better. I think we've got to look at it as if, how do we get better at nurturing the kids and making them understand and getting the answers out of them the right way instead of just being complacent with what we've got. We've always got to get better at what we do.
Yeah, I agree.
And
the thing is, you know, we know that individuals thrive when they're in environments where they feel safe and they feel comfortable. And if this is making them feel uncomfortable, then the way your brain works, they are not going to give you the best answers when they start to feel uncomfortable, nor the ones that represent them the best. So you've got to create an environment as best you can in this situation where they feel safe and comfortable with you to then relax a little bit. And then you really will get a good insight as to how well this kid can think.
100%. Thanks for your call, Tony. And also remember that, like, you know, it's funny that somebody says you're just trying to defend your job. Well, no, because you don't work in that space, well, not directly in that particular thing, but also right now you're a radio person who's talking about something that's in the paper today.
Correct.
Right now we're both sitting on air talking about stuff that's relevant to sport because we're a sports station.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's trying to defend their job. But I understand where it comes from. Like, as soon as we open the door on stuff like this, it's very emotive. Listening to Melbourne's Home of Sport, we'll be back on the other side of this.
On 1116 SEN, Melbourne's home of footy, The Science of Sport, with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada and Mark Fabreo. So good,
I got you. Oh, welcome back to RiptonRockHard.com. Jackie Lada, Ripton Rock Hard. Of course, it is Melbourne's home of football, and this is The Science of Sport. Every Sunday between 10 and 11, Jackie Lada, sometimes Professor Mark Fabreo, and most of the time, myself, at 17 minutes to 11 o'clock. Now, if you've been sending through SMSs, it's just been brought to my attention by my very lovely co-host that, well, I'm looking at all of these SMSs coming through. I'm like, these are all a bit irrelevant and don't really make much sense to the conversation. Then I've realised they're all from last hour. So we're just all last hour's SMSs are coming through. So if you've sent something, hopefully we'll have it soon. But as of right now, we don't have it. So we're not ignoring you and we're not being rude. We just don't have...
We're just a little delayed.
Yeah, we don't have any SMSs coming through from this hour. But I tell you what we do have coming through, some great advice. Because, Jackie, I want to tap into that brain of yours and I want to talk about something which is very topical and seasonal and fast approaching, which is the new year.
Yeah.
Now, we're only going to have this conversation once this year, and this is the once. This is the once. Okay. So for better or worse, intelligently or unintelligently, this is the time of the year where people quite often stumble towards the new year and say, it's all right, I'll just keep abusing myself until January 1 because that is the day where my thinking, habits, behaviours will transform. I will become a new, improved version of me. My life will be amazing.
Yep.
And I will turn my world around on January 1. Now, we know that statistically... That's not likely.
No.
We know that just purely
from... Should we give the statistics?
Purely just from a data perspective and a results perspective, it's unlikely that you're going to change your life or any part thereof on January 1.
Yeah. The statistics are hilarious. So a couple of years ago, there was a study done and the research came out 24 hours after New Year's. What percentage of the population do you think were still sticking to their New Year's resolution?
What percentage?
24 hours after New Year's, do you think we're still sticking to it?
Well, I would have thought 80%.
Yeah, no, you're about 37.
Are still doing it?
Yeah. Or, it was very, very low.
So 63% have dropped off.
Well, possibly they were drunk when
they made it. Hang on. So are you saying that, because this is going to change, this is going to change my presentations, because I've been giving out the wrong data. So all you people have heard me speak... I've got some new data. So 63% of people who set a New Year's resolution fall off the resolution.
Fall off within about 24, 48 hours is what this particular article was saying. This was about 5-6 years ago I read this.
And I guess the irony of that is that a lot of those people have been waiting for days, weeks, months for New Year's to roll around because that's the life-changing day.
Yeah. Yeah, when is this...
But, like...
Sorry, I've thrown
How
you.
Funny is it that we think, and I guess I've thought it at times, but how funny is it that we think that just because it's a certain date on the calendar, certain day of the week or a certain day of the month, that, right, that it's going to happen. When we don't actually say, well, what are the things which really determine success or failure in the transformation space? Is it really about what day I start, or is it really about whether or not I'm actually ready to do what's required to create those results?
Yeah, I think it's are you ready? It's also the planning involved. But it's really no different to somebody who says, you know, they were wanting to eat healthy, and all of a sudden they've started eating bad food, and they've gone, oh, well, I've already started now, I may as well keep going. So it's not just about a New Year's thing. It's this whole, oh, I've done a little bit wrong, so I may as well just keep going. So I think the thing is with New Year's resolution, by the time this particular article said, by the time you get to 6 months, 0.3 of the population are still sticking to the New Year's resolution they said at New Year's. And yeah. I think that's because it's a goal setting process. You have to look at all the barriers. How many times have you tried this before? What are you doing to actually prepare yourself? Are you waiting for this magic dust to just spill out of the sky on the 1st of January? That's going to be all of a sudden make you more motivated than you've ever been, able to stick to something. Know your own personality. If you've never been able to stick to something before, then you've got to understand why and probably change the resources and support around you in preparing for that.
I always say, Jackie Lauder, et al.,
yep,
that there's a dichotomy, because on the one hand, we say we want to change, learn, grow, evolve, become new and improved. But on the other hand, we like being comfortable, right?
Well, human beings are control freaks. We like to be in control. We don't like discomfort.
Yeah. And the truth is that quite often, at least for a while, the change process is uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so
it will be. Yep.
It will be. So we go, well, what do you want more? Do you want to change more, or do you want to be comfortable more? And it's more than that, but sometimes that's a big part of it. And
discomfort's not bad, though. I think people think it's a bad thing. It's a just transformational thing. Exactly.
And I think the thing is that many people love the notion, the idea, the theory, the concept, the intention of transformation, but not the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And because, one, the journey's not quick necessarily, no, or convenient or comfortable.
And we live in a society of convenience.
And comfort and ease and predictability and familiarity. And when you take all those things out and go, look, you know, this is going to suck, but that's okay. It won't suck all the time or forever. But for a while, it'll hurt a bit, and it might hurt emotionally or mentally or physically. It'll be inconvenient. It won't happen by Tuesday.
But if you're well-resourced.
Yeah, and if you dig deep, what will happen on the transformation journey is not only will you get where you want to go, but you will become stronger. You will develop skills. You'll develop resilience and awareness and insight that you didn't have, so that next time you do something comparable, it won't be so hard.
Yeah, and I think if you put the right people around you that can keep supporting your journey and remind you that it's going to be tough, and also not try and force you through it where they go, don't worry, just suck it up, princess, it'll be okay.
Yeah,
It's okay to go, man, this is hard, or I'm really struggling with this today, or I don't like this. And I'm not saying get into this pattern of whinging all the time, but don't dismiss someone when they say, gee, I'm really struggling with this. Okay, yep, I've struggled with this before. And that's one of the big things I always try and do with my clients is show them that I'm human too. I don't do everything perfectly. I don't have, you know, I get up early and I'm very disciplined and all that, but I have moments where I'm not. I have moments where I can't be bothered doing something. So no one is motivated all the time or does it perfectly. If you've got those people around you that allow you to experience it and still be safe, you'll get there.
What about this notion of, I don't know if this is sciencey enough or psyche enough for you, but this notion of, you know, creating habits that are hardwired into your subconscious. So just things that you do on autopilot. Yep. So like people go to me, how do you stay motivated to train all the time? You're so old. You're so broken. I say, thank you. Thank you, Mum.
You're so old. Really?
But the truth is I don't stay motivated in inverted commas because for me it's just hardwired. Like I get up in the morning and I don't think, will I or won't I? I just look at my calendar and go, right, I'm free between 4 and 6, so I'll do it in there.
Yeah, I mean, and it is different for different people. Like I get up and I've got to get my exercise done first thing in the morning because if it's going to be hard – I get up and I don't think about it and it's done before I've really got time to go, do I want to do this or not? Whereas if I'm waiting till later in the day where I'm tired or it really is interrupting my day, I'm going to get agitated about it. So you've got to know your own systems and your own body and be prepared to acknowledge those.
Mm.
But also, when you see all of these people that have great success, you know, whether it be losing weight or getting fit or just, you know, they can all of a sudden run 5K when they couldn't even run 500 meters or lift something that they couldn't lift before.
Yeah.
Those people are normal human beings who have just found the right system for them to be able to achieve success in their chosen goal.
I think also another thing, like I think there are certain things that we do on autopilot, like clean our teeth, like get up, have a shower, like be polite to people, like pay taxes, go to whatever, right? And I go, well, there are certain things that you don't do them because you love them or they're fun or they're awesome or you're pumped or you just do those because somewhere in that computer that sits between your ears is a command that says, no, that's not optional.
Yep.
No, you need to get up, clean your teeth, have a shower. Yeah, you need to go to work, right? Now, imagine if we could take that kind of automation and plug in the other things, you know, like I'm not talking about extreme things, but like eating well all the time or moving our body, not being obsessed, but just moving our body consistently, not in fits and starts, not I was in the zone for 3 weeks, then on the couch for 3 months.
Yep. Get rid of your absolute language too. Like I need to do this every day.
Mm.
I have to do this. You know, I've got to do it all the time. You don't. That's a lot of pressure, and that's what I think freaks people out. And straight away they go into this anxiety zone where they say, oh, I'm not going to be able to do that all the time. Well, we don't. And I said to someone the other day, you know, they look at the footage that we see of elite athletes in those sessions where they're sweating it up and burning lots of energy and whatever it is. What the cameras do not show is that we spend far more time in recovery. They don't show the hour then they have to eat straight away. They then have to have a massage. They sit in an ice bath. You know, they'll put ice on their bodies or whatever it is. They'll go and stand in the ocean. You see snippets, but you don't see that there's more time in the recovery phase 100%. Than there is 100%. In the intensity phase.
The other night, just quickly before we go to the break, I did a session with the Melbourne Vixens. Shout out to the Vixen girls. And who's playing that already? It was funny because they turned up to training at 3:30, warm up, stretching, taping, hard training, shoved some food in their mouth. They met with me at 6, and then they were with me till 8. So that's 5 hours, right, back-to-back stuff. And a lot of these girls have jobs and go to uni.
Yeah.
It's a full-on thing. Let's go to a break now.
On 11.16 SEN, Melbourne's home of footy, The Science of Sport, with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada and Mark Fabreo.
Welcome back to Melbourne's home of sport, The Science of Sport. We're nearly done and dusted after 11 o'clock, between 11 and midday, in fact. First serve with BP. He will carry on from there because he is a radio cyborg. He just goes... He's like the Energizer Bunny of media. He'll be here between 12 and 6 doing Sunday Sports Central. He does a mighty fine job. There is no one that preps better than BP because he does 7-hour stints.
That's a hard gig, isn't it?
I don't know anyone in radio in Australia who, I'm not talking about through the day, does essentially a 7-hour shift. So he's a superstar. He'll be here after 11. Jackie Lauder. Now all of our things have come through, but a bit too late.
Yeah, they have. We've come through a bit late, but we've got people talking, haven't we?
We certainly
not
have.
Happy.
There's a few happy people. Yeah. There's a few unhappy people, but you know, we can agree to disagree on some things. I don't think we need to hate each other because we have different opinions.
Yeah,
we can share the love, can't we?
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, the thing is, as we've said before, this is what we do every day, like involved in this scene. So we do have a lot more insight into, you know, some things that are working and not working. And these are our jobs from a professional perspective. We don't always agree inside a footy club or inside a basketball team or whatever it is. And you have to have some pretty robust conversations to eventually get where you need to go. So
even you and I, in the context of this show, don't always agree.
Totally.
That's okay. Who wants two people who think the same thing all
it's
the time?
And
it gets super boring.
Yep.
Well, folks, I'm suggesting to you don't wait until January 1 because statistically, Jackie has shared with us, it's a pointless process. If you're going to do something, maybe do something today. BP's on his way. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday and we'll catch up with you next Sunday.
See you next week.